The headlines: Pakistan's parliament convenes to elect a new prime minister amid political tensions following the ouster of Imran Khan in a no-confidence vote. The number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank since Sunday rises to 4, as a state of alert is announced in parts of the occupied territory. And Ukraine says 9 humanitarian corridors have been agreed for Monday between Kiev and Moscow to evacuate people from eastern regions. Hello and welcome, everybody. Hours after the ouster of Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, his supporters take to the streets to express opposition to the parliamentary no-confidence vote against him. Thousands of people rallied in different Pakistani cities. They held placards and chanted slogans in support of Khan's party, Tehreek-e-Insaf. The protesters called the dismissed Prime Minister the choice of the people. Khan was unseated on Sunday after a day-long impasse in Parliament. Finally, the opposition secured a majority vote in support of a no-confidence motion against him. He's accused of political and economic failures, but says he has fallen victim to a U.S.-backed regime change plot. Pakistan's Parliament is meeting later Monday to elect a new Prime Minister. Opposition leader Shehbaz Sharif is the likely candidate to replace Khan. Palestinians have held a funeral procession for a 17-year-old man who succumbed to his injuries after Israeli forces shot him in Jenin in the occupied West Bank a day earlier. Mohammad Zakarneh's death raises the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since Sunday to 4. He was among the 10 Palestinians injured by Israeli live fire amid tensions over a Palestinian retaliatory attack that killed 3 in Tel Aviv on Wednesday. Regime forces also arrested 20 others. Resistance groups in Jenin have declared a state of alert to confront Israeli raids. 2 Palestinian women and 1 man were also shot dead across the occupied West Bank on Sunday, one of them a widowed mother of 6. Palestinians have ramped up their resistance against the regime over the past months. They say this is a legitimate response to Israeli crimes and occupation. Ukraine says 9 humanitarian corridors have been agreed for Monday between Kiev and Moscow to evacuate people from the besieged eastern regions. The planned corridors include 5 in the Luhansk region. 1 corridor is for people evacuating by private vehicle from the city of Mariupol. Ukraine says around 2,900 were evacuated through humanitarian corridors on Sunday. The UN says the conflict has so far displaced 7.1 million people inside Ukraine. The body says over 4.5 million Ukrainians have fled the country since the Russian offensive started. According to UN figures, 90% of the refugees are women and children, as Ukrainian authorities don't allow men of military age to leave the country. Poland hosts the largest number of refugees. The Russian Human Rights Commissioner confirms that Moscow and Kiev have carried out another prisoner exchange despite an ongoing conflict between the 2 neighbors. Tatiana Moskalkova says 4 employees of Russia's Atomic Energy Corporation have returned home from Ukraine. According to the commissioner, some Russian soldiers and civilians have also been freed. The move includes the release of a number of Russian and Ukrainian truck drivers as well. Ukraine has confirmed the latest prisoner swap. The deputy prime minister says a dozen Ukrainian soldiers and 14 civilians have been freed as part of the prisoner swap. This was the 3rd exchange of soldiers and civilians held by Kiev and Moscow since the start of the conflict. The World Bank has forecast a bleak economic outlook for Ukraine and the region amid Russia's military operation in the country. In a report, the bank predicted that Ukraine's economy will collapse by more than 45% this year. The projected figure is far worse than the 10 to 35% downturn the International Monetary Fund predicted last month. The bank added that Russia will also see a more than 11% decline in its GDP. The World Bank said the entire region is suffering from economic consequences as a result of the war, adding the conflict has caused prices of grains and energy to shoot up as well. The Washington-based institution reiterated that this is the 2nd major shock to the regional economy in 2 years after the coronavirus pandemic. And the United States has reaffirmed commitment to supplying arms to Ukraine in its ongoing conflict with Russia. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said his country will provide Ukraine with weapons it needs so that it will be able to beat back Russia. Sullivan added Washington has been working round the clock to deliver such weapons. That's why the Ukrainian president has expressed skepticism that Washington would arm Kiev in a way it has vowed to do. In an interview with CBS News, Vladimir Zelensky said he doesn't have the confidence that his country will be receiving the much-needed arms. He also called on the EU to impose more sanctions on Moscow. In a telephone conversation with the German Chancellor, Zelensky demanded embargo on Russian oil and gas. Germany has so far resisted doing so due to its heavy reliance on Russian energy. However, Germany's gas imports from Russia have been cut by around 15%. And in other news, with 97% of the votes counted in France's presidential election, incumbent Emmanuel Macron and far-right leader Marine Le Pen head for the April 24th runoff. The latest results show Macron on top with more than 27% of the votes. Le Pen comes second with over 23%. This would be a repeat of the 2017 runoff between the two candidates, but this year the gap between them has become much closer. Macron and Le Pen have campaigned on sharply opposing views. For France, Le Pen has pledged radical domestic and international changes for the country, but Macron criticizes her approach as one aligned with populists and xenophobes. He called the upcoming 2 weeks a decisive period for the future of France and for Europe.
The first round of the French presidential election is finished, and as expected, there will be a repeat of 2017. Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen will duel once again in the second round of voting.
Maybe the French people will surprise everyone and elect Marine Le Pen. This is her second time making it to the second round, and maybe people will give her a chance. But I think Macron will win because too many people are either scared to vote for Le Pen or feel they will be disappointed by her.
I think Macron is brilliant and that he has handled the coronavirus crisis very well. Le Pen is too racist and too extreme right.
Macron's team brushed off recent polls that actually have Le Pen winning in the second round, as she has soared in the last month to make the race a dead heat.
Now everything begins. We need to explain the project we had for the five coming years with the president, because the president was not in a position to completely explain his project. He was at work for the French people because of the Ukrainian crisis.
In a close third place, just 1% behind Le Pen, was Jean-Luc Mélenchon, a former Socialist Party minister who turned left. In a bid to win over centrists, he didn't embrace the yellow vests, and barring a huge cache of votes somewhere, he's headed home and perhaps has aged out of politics. In fourth place, with a disappointing 7%, was mainstream media pundit Eric Zemmour, who was seemingly given control of the campaign agenda for months, despite setting new lows in Islamophobia and racism. The mainstream conservative candidate, Valérie Pécresse, was a distant fifth. The so-called Sarkozyist candidate didn't even get the endorsement of former President Nicolas Sarkozy. The once mighty Socialist Party might be finished after garnering less than 2%, and only the two communist candidates scored less. Finishing a surprising seventh was Jean Lassalle, the only MP to wear a yellow vest in French Parliament. Parliament immediately suspended itself, and LaSalle was fined.
Is Le Pen still so shocking after 5 years of Macronism and in a post-Donald Trump world? Has Macron provided enough stability in a post-coronavirus landscape? We'll have the verdict of France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahar, Paris.
Well, France faces a brutal two-week campaign over the country's future as a centrist incumbent Emmanuel Macron faces the far-right Marine Le Pen. For the presidency, hashtag trending takes a review of social media's response to developments in Europe's second-largest economy. Moving on, Italy's nurses and healthcare workers have staged a national strike affecting hospitals across the country. Unionists are calling on the government to review the collective contract adjusting salaries to meet changes in skyrocketing cost of living.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses had been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten.
In the midst of the pandemic, the Prime Minister himself said we won't forget about the nurses. The truth is that they have forgotten about us. We were expecting a pay raise considering the challenges and the suffering we had to go through during the pandemic. Negotiations are underway for the contractual renewal of the health sector. Let's see how it unfolds.
About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany, and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran standing its ground over the JCPOA revival talks. Tehran says Washington is yet to show a real will to return to its commitments by removing the so-called maximum pressure campaign in whole.
Unfortunately, the U.S. seeks to keep in place elements of the maximum pressure campaign, which was designed by those who opposed the JCPOA. All elements of that campaign created to prevent the Iranian nation from reaping economic benefits of the JCPOA must be removed.
Khatibzadeh said the U.S. has delayed the necessary political decisions to settle the remaining issues for months. He said Iran has offered the U.S. some initiatives and it's ready to finish the Vienna talks on the revival of the deal as soon as it receives the necessary signals. The Iranian official, however, warned that the window of opportunity will not remain open forever. The Vienna negotiations between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA have been paused since a month ago, with a number of issues still unresolved. And Iran has launched an exhibition to display its latest achievements in the field of nuclear and relevant technologies, including therapies, products, and new equipment. This is part of the country's programs to mark the National Day of Nuclear Technology. Yusuf Jalali has a report on that.
A glimpse into Iran's capabilities in the nuclear industry. This exhibition showcases the latest made-in-Iran nuclear products, ranging from radiopharmaceuticals to plasma therapy for cancer patients. Among them is Gallophabi, a radiomedicine used in the efficient diagnosis of cancer. Its developers say it is an outstanding achievement in the nuclear sector. For security reasons, we cannot show the experts' faces.
This radiomedicine can diagnose some 30 types of cancers. It uses gallium-68 that is sensitive to a certain protein associated with cancerous cells. That's how it can precisely detect the position of tumors.
The device we presented today is a type of PET scan machine. It's an imaging technique that injects a radioactive drug or a tracer in the body to show both normal and abnormal metabolic activities in the body.
The exhibition comes as part of ceremonies marking the National Day of Nuclear Technology, which falls on April 9th. It commemorates Iran's first enrichment of uranium at an industrial scale in 2006. In addition to the 77 new achievements displayed here, on Saturday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi unveiled what he called comprehensive strategic document for nuclear development. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the document provides a roadmap for the country's nuclear program in the next two decades. Since Iran indigenized its nuclear industry, it has always been haunted by sanctions. In 2015, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, was signed between Iran and the world powers, which promised a sanctions relief for the country in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The U.S. left the accord in 2018 and reinstated its sanctions, prompting Iran to retaliate by scaling back its commitments to the JCPOA. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have been engaged in the Vienna talks to salvage the accord. The discussions envisage the removal of all sanctions against Iran in return for the country, coming back to full compliance with the agreement.
By displaying these nuclear products, Iran tries to show the West that sanctions have not been an obstacle to its nuclear ambitions. At the same time, it wants to tell the JCPOA parties that Tehran will continue to develop its nuclear industry even beyond the JCPOA limits, if sanctions are not removed. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. This is the part of a speech delivered on March 10th, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the ninth session of the Assembly. One important issue in the management of the country and the public life of the people is for the facilitation of their issues. Because the people's presence is very important and because the presence is dependent on such matters. You can see how big and small devils are trying to deceive the people. As the leader of the devils said, "Then by your power, I will pull them all into the wrong." Holy Quran, chapter 38, verse 82. They are constantly trying to entice people using the media that today facilitates spreading any speech, decorates any lie, and justifies any wrong statement. They're constantly sending information into the depth of society's mind. They are deceiving people. "Then by your power, I will put them all into the wrong." Again, this verse of Quran. They are constantly doing such things in order to discourage people from having faith, self-confidence, hope, and the things that I mentioned before. They want to take away people's self-confidence.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
People's trust in the officials and weakened national unity, these are things the enemy is doing. Their ultimate goal is to deceive the masses of the people, but they want to do this by deceiving outstanding personalities first. Today, one of their important plots is deceiving outstanding personalities in society. People who have high positions, resources, expertise, or other such things. When outstanding personalities are deceived, they will easily deceive the masses of the people. If they are given the opportunity to do so, one of the most intense soft wars in the history of our country is being conducted in this way. They are constantly training mercenaries and enticing them in subtle ways to take forbidden money. When people get used to taking forbidden money like a ferocious animal, it becomes very difficult to stop them. They are training mercenaries, some with threats and others with temptations, and all sorts of tricks. Therefore, there is a serious soft war going on at the present time. Let us pose this question. Why is this soft war against us so harsh? The reason is that we have become strong. We have indeed become strong. Today, the camp of the truth has become strong in terms of infrastructures and resources.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tel Aviv has been the scene of yet another Palestinian operation. On Thursday, a Palestinian man opened fire at Israelis in the heart of a city, killing three and injuring eight others. He was shot dead by Israeli forces after a nine-hour manhunt. Palestinian resistance groups praised the attack as a heroic operation, calling it a natural response to Israeli crimes. The Popular Resistance Committee, a coalition of a number of armed Palestinian groups, says the operation exposed the regime's fragility and weakness. The comments were echoed by Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah, which hailed the recent shooting operation in Tel Aviv as a legitimate response to crimes committed by the Israeli regime. Thursday's attack was the fourth such operation in the past 2 weeks. Late last month, a Palestinian shooting operation killed five people in a Tel Aviv suburb. Attacks in the northern city of Hadera and the southern city of Beersheba had killed six Israelis days earlier. But the question is, what's behind the uptick in the number of attacks that's been described as one of the deadliest waves of Palestinian operations in years?
We are suffering daily from their homes being confiscated, their lives being taken, children being arrested on an almost daily basis and taken off to jail. So for every action, there is a reaction, and repression builds resistance. So I think we are seeing an outcry of despair, but also a strengthening of resistance against the continued illegal occupation of the West Bank.
As tensions mount in the occupied territories, Israel is bracing for more Palestinian operations in the days to come. The events that are unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of hostilities that culminated in the 11-day war on Gaza in May last year, during which over 250 Palestinians, including scores of women and children, were killed in the besieged enclave. The international community called for an immediate end to the war, but stopped short of condemning Israel for the deadly and devastating onslaught after it was over. The world also seems to have turned a blind eye to Israel's land grab and expansionist policies that see hundreds of Palestinian-owned structures razed to the ground every year. The years-long blockade on Gaza Strip, settlers' violence against Palestinians, and Israel's illegal settlement construction activities also seem to be going unnoticed. When some Arab states announced the normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering.
You've mentioned all the usual suspects who give political coverage and the fig leaf of respectability to the apartheid Israeli regime, remembering that Israel is a white colonial European colonization project within the Middle East. But you've left out the other group of people, the other organization that have condemned Palestinian violence, but have not condemned Israeli violence, and that is the Palestinian Authority, which is led by the unelected Mahmoud Abbas. So while all these other people are held to account for their failure to hold to account Israeli apartheid atrocities and war crimes, let us not forget the PA, and Mahmoud Abbas.
In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish Consul General's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia. The Turkish court's ruling has been widely denounced. Rights groups called the move an appalling whitewash. Khashoggi's Turkish fiancé says she has been surprised and saddened by the decision, which she described as political. Following the court's ruling, Hatice Cengiz said Saudi Arabia is a country where there is no justice and that no one expects a just decision there. She also pledged to appeal the court ruling. The Turkish U-turn on the murder trial comes as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is trying to mend ties with the Saudis. The Khashoggi case has been a major obstacle to warmer political relations between the two sides. But why does Turkey need to reset its ties with the oil-rich kingdom so much? Turkey is grappling with a severe economic downturn, and the Turkish leader is facing an election next year.
I think it has everything to do with trying to mend ties with Saudi Arabia. I think Turkey has been chasing reconciliation with its former antagonist. We've seen that it's reconciled with the UAE. We've seen that it's been making concessions to Egypt, that it's been restricting the activity of Egyptian opposition in Istanbul and telling Egyptian opposition critics in Istanbul to tone down their criticism of Sisi in a bid to try to get Egypt to accept a reconciliation. And likewise, we're seeing Turkey make strenuous efforts in order to convince Mohammed bin Salman to end the Saudi boycott of Turkish goods.
Riyadh had made it clear to Ankara that a thaw could only come if Ankara drops the case against the kingdom. The Turkish court's ruling has left little doubt that cash-strapped Ankara wants a thaw in ties with the wealthy Saudis to such an extent that it is willing to drop the high-profile case for good.
So what Turkey is essentially doing, it's handing the issue over to Saudi Arabia and saying, for us, the matter is closed, and we're going to allow you to close the matter as well permanently so that nobody officially in the international community can talk about Khashoggi anymore.
Saudi petrodollars seem to be once again giving the kingdom impunity for its horrific crimes.
Russia has warned the West against disrupting peace talks with Ukraine. Foreign Minister Lavrov says Russia believes the West is enabling hysteria around the alleged mass killings in the Ukrainian town to derail the peace talks between Moscow and Kiev. We tend to think that the reason lies in the desire to find a reason to disrupt the ongoing negotiations and to do it exactly at the moment when, as they say, the light, even if not bright, but nevertheless began to dawn. According to Lavrov, in the course of negotiations with Russia, Kiev had for the first time put on paper its readiness to declare itself neutral, not aligned to any bloc, and non-nuclear. Lavrov insisted that the Ukrainians had formalized a refusal to deploy the weapons of foreign states on their territory or to conduct exercises there with the participation of a foreign military without the consent of all guarantor states of the future treaty, including Russia. The remarks by the Russian top diplomats highlight the possibility that Ukraine's Western backers may have different motivations or reservations about a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. For some NATO countries, the war between Ukraine and Russia is preferable to a peace deal.
Well, obviously, Ukraine is being utilized by NATO in a very dangerous experiment. And it's not the first time this has happened. This has really been kind of a century-old project dating back to after the First World War, when there was an attempt to prevent the growth of large major countries like Germany and Russia, so that Central Europe has always been used by, in those days, by the British and these days by the Americans as a wedge against any major country that might become a competitor.
The there is a long track record of influential foreign policy thinkers who suggested America would benefit from Russia fighting an insurgency in Ukraine. The latest official to express the benefits of Ukrainian insurgency is U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Carle. I think with a high degree of certainty that Russia will emerge from Ukraine weaker than it went into the conflict. Militarily weaker, economically weaker, politically and geopolitically weaker, and more isolated.
Unfortunately, the United States is continuing to work, as they did after World War II in Ukraine, against the Soviet Union to ally themselves with extremely right-wing forces who earlier had been associated with the Nazis. And that is a real factor in Ukraine. And it's undeniable. And the United States is playing with them as a tool in a game against Russia. It's hard to say what the end game there is.
U.S. officials say they are skeptical that the Ukrainian government's negotiations with Russia will lead to a swift deal. And they are considering how a settlement will impact the security of NATO nations. Some European countries, especially formerly communist ones, are especially nervous about how the conflict will evolve. They believe if Russia feels it has profited from the invasion, it may eventually be inspired to try the same thing against other neighbors. NATO leaders say the Ukrainians are involved in a broader fight on behalf of Europe. Even a Ukrainian vow not to join NATO could be a concern for some neighbors. Therefore, it appears that for some in NATO, it's better for the Ukrainians to keep fighting and dying than to achieve peace. They believe the peace deal would come too early or at too high a cost to Kiev and the rest of Europe. European members themselves do not appear united on how much of a direct threat Russia poses to the alliance. Germany and France are more inclined than their allies in Eastern Europe to feel that Moscow's aims stop at the NATO border. For countries that are closer to the war, there is a belief that they have more at stake.
Violent clashes between Sri Lankan police and anti-government protesters across the country have become commonplace in recent days. The protesters are angry at the government's handling of the country's worst economic crisis since its 1948 independence from the United Kingdom. The economic downturn has led to long lines for fuel, a short supply of essential goods, and seven-hour-long power cuts every day. The protesters are calling on President Gotabaya Rajapaksa to resign. The president, however, remains defiant. He declared a state of emergency on Friday and announced a curfew to quell the protests. However, the demonstrations show no sign of dying down anytime soon. The government blames the COVID-19 pandemic for the devaluation of the national currency and other economic woes. It says the outbreak has slashed revenues from tourism and the inward flow of foreign exchanges. But that's not the whole picture, at least according to economic experts.
The situation has been exacerbated in Sri Lanka due to the mismanagement, the political crisis, the corruption. The president and the prime minister are brothers. One of the nephews is a minister in the government. So it's extraordinary sort of nepotism which is happening in Sri Lanka. So that's one of the contributory factors.
A government expenditure that exceeds its income, ill-timed tax cuts, and a sudden shift toward organic farming that hamstrung the food industry in the country are also cited as reasons why the Sri Lankan economy is now in the doldrums. Sri Lanka is facing imminent default with over $7 billion of debt due this year, $1 billion of which are international bonds that will mature in July. This is while the country's usable currency reserves are estimated to have fallen to as low as $500 million. To stave off defaulting on its debt, Colombo has turned to regional superpowers, India and China, for bailout loans, securing a $1 billion credit line from the New Delhi late last month. But that's far from enough,
which leaves Sri Lanka with not many more alternatives than the International Monetary Fund. But securing a loan from the IMF will come at a cost too, as the international lender would require Sri Lanka to implement fundamental changes to its fiscal and economic policies, something that experts believe would put much more pressure on the poor. Besides, as some commentators suggest, the demanded restructuring could infringe on Colombo's sovereignty.
As soon as IMF loans money to any nation, they want austerity measures. What that means in simple language is they want subsidies to be taken away from basic things that ordinary people use. Because what you've got to remember that in a developing country like Sri Lanka, the main budget of the ordinary masses is on food and accommodation and energy. They don't have any sort of residual income to buy luxuries. And if inflation goes up by 40% in these sectors, then it has a huge impact on the ordinary people.
No matter what route the country will choose, one thing is for certain. As long as the current economic climate stands, the developing nations would suffer under skyrocketing consumer prices, fuel shortages, and power cuts, which means more protests and political uncertainty in the indebted nations.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali Himani and Shaykh Qasim. Salaam alaikum to both of you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on the show.
So for today's discussion, we want to talk about college education. How essential is it? I mean, university and college education. And do we need at all a college education or not? You know, nowadays, the case of self-study without going to the college, because, you know, you can find the teaching courses on different materials online.
Videos, even the videos online.
Even the videos and all of that. So a person can be sitting in the house, you know, looking at them and finding them without going to the university. But this degree-based lifestyle, you know, just getting to the... Because whenever you are going to apply for a job, the first question that they ask in your CV, resume, that's right, is your education. You know, what is your education and degree? And from the other side, we had some exceptions during the history that they become great people, but when they left the university or left, the, for example, the official formal education. But I still think that this college education has a role in shaping the human personality, because till that time, you do not know what you want to do for your future. But upon a chance or a random checking of a specific major at the university, which is mostly done without interest at that age, your whole life will be changed into a doctor or an engineer or a physicist or a chemist or something like that, okay?
Or a materialist.
Or a materialist or something like that. I do want to say what to do to guide our desires, I mean, in pursuing knowledge or in pursuing a specific science.
Yeah,
is there at all a way, or no, we have to?
Yeah, for sure. Again, I have to reemphasize on the fact that we have, I know, we have to take these two sides simultaneously. So having the line of education, college education or the classic education that we take, on one side, and on the other side, the knowledge, especially the spiritual knowledge or the religious knowledge that we have to have on the other side, we have to grow both of them simultaneously. Mm-hmm. But what I want to say is that, you know, I believe that the reason that he asked the question, the previous question, and the answer that the Sheikh Kadhim, Sheikh Ali gave, was that, you know, we see some people that get, you know, frustrated not going to colleges, you know, and universities because of not having enough money or, I don't know, not having enough time or any, you know, they're not capable of going to colleges for any reason. So is it the end of the world for them not going to college or not? I believe that, you know, these universities and colleges, maybe the most important thing that you can get out of this college or university is a sort of certificate or a sort of, you know, reassurance that this person is skillful and is, you know, is enoughly learned to do that job. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for example, neuroscientist or I don't know, neurosurgeon. So that certificate that you get, that degree that you get, it shows that you are qualified for, I don't know, doing surgery or things like that.
Okay.
But if you can get that, you know, that trustworthiness from somewhere else, like showing yourself that you're skillful at that job, that again, you know, can suffice. For example, yeah, for sure, for some jobs, we cannot, I don't know, we cannot... have a person there who claims that I'm a surgeon.
I have certain problem with this new but world order, engineer, you know.
No, but with an engineer. So okay. Again, I want to quote what you yourself said, yes, that, you know, we have many giants in the science,
yes,
that have not passed, I don't know, maybe the higher education, yes, sometimes. But they prove that they are worthy of being, you know, a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay,
this is what I mean. So, you know, I believe that the skill is at the core of everything. So that certificate that the college or university gives you is a sort of insurance, the reinsurance, and you know, a proof for that skill that you may have. So
that's
if
right,
you can prove that skill that you have in another way, other than, you know, having the certificate or having that degree,
mm-hmm,
that is worthy again. So. Yeah.
Again, I've got this problem with this world. I mean, is that all human being was created for such, you know, aim? I mean, to have past courses.
This
is a big philosophical, ontological question about,
correct,
you know, the very...
Well, before going there,
yes,
let me just clarify a couple of points, what Sheikh Qasim has mentioned here.
True that skill plays a very vital role, but there are certain skills which are high-risk skills. Like, for example, someone who can drop out of school and learn programming by himself, you know, all by himself, and then go out and present and then, you know, show the code that, look, I wrote this code and this is what is the outcome, and I'm able to do that without necessarily having to go to college. And that's okay. He's able to establish his credibility there. But there are certain skills where the life of people depend on that. Yeah, sure. And that is where, even if you show that, you look, I can, you know, perform a surgery on surgery of the brain or the heart because I worked with an ex-doctor and all that, people will find it difficult to trust on you until unless they really see that you're a well-educated person and all that. So I think we need to categorize these areas into different fields where there are high-risk areas and there are low-risk areas. In the low-risk areas, in all the areas, skills play the vital role. But in the low-risk area, people will find it easy to trust on you and allow you to access their car or their AC or their washing machine and even computer, hardware, software. Because the risk there is just the financial risk, not the risk of the life.
So the issue is the credibility. So
the credibility and the amount of risk that is being placed here. You know, if I know that a particular doctor is specialized pediatrician who knows the in and outs of children's problems, I can go to him. Right, but I know that there's a doctor who's, you know, world number one, but he's not a pediatrician. I would be worried to take my son or daughter to him because I know that he knows the in and out, but he doesn't know how the system for the children work, right? So I think there are areas that we need to categorize, that these are high-risk areas. This is where I don't think people will compromise, even if I promote the idea that skill is important, but people, they will not compromise on these areas. So I think we can categorize and say that certain areas, it's okay if you don't go. Even if you're a dropout, you can learn by yourself. But certain areas definitely need that specialization.
Yeah, I'm
so
going back
what about past that the college education was not there? What about the past that the college university education was not there as the official thing? There were some learnings, but the people lived long. The people lived better than today. You know, I think the lifestyle was good. Of course, there have been some diseases and the pandemics killed so many people. But I don't think that, for example, degree at the college or university helped the people in order to have a more prosperous life, in quotes, you know, in both this world and the other world.
Yeah, the expectation of people has raised, you know, during these years, maybe 200 years, since 200 years till now. So, yeah, maybe before it was like the way that you described. But nowadays, you know, as the brother mentioned, you know, again, I have to emphasize under the credibility. So those high risk, professions. The credibility is not built there. So, you know, because for example, if a person you encounter a person that you're not sure that this person is skillful in that area or not, you're not going to give him the job that you have.
Okay.
But before, I know in the past, it was not like that. The expectation of people was not like that, because the knowledge was not developed at that time. So if there was a person, I don't know who could do even a standard things to do, he would be respected a lot. Even a nurse would be respected, like a physician is respected. But now the expectation is high. But I want to go back to the question that you asked in the earlier question that you had. That is there any sort of conflict between the knowledge and science? Is it our goal just to go for science, or the other way around? Is it our goal just to go for knowledge and spiritual knowledge and Islamic teachings, for example? I think again I have to say that there is no conflict here. Both of them are valued in Islam, but one thing has to be take into consideration, which is everything that you do in your life has to be for the sake of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and for the prosperity of yes. you and the human beings, in both in this life and the right. life to come. And I want to make use of this actually opportunity that I have to ask our brothers and sisters who are listening to this, that even though, for example, I don't know, they are doing their education in, I don't know, in medicine or in engineering or whatever they're doing, software, whatever.
Yes.
They try their best to do ikhlas in those things, you know,
yes.
because they would reach at an age where they see and look back, you know, and say, you know, they have everything, they have money, they have, you know, everything, but they, you know, and they are good people, they are, yes. you know, Muslims, good Muslims, yeah. but unfortunately what they have done is not based on ikhlas and, you know, for the sake of Allah subhanahu yes. wa ta'ala. So they try to, you know, to purify their intention for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and for serving the religion of Islam and the
yes.
School of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam.
Okay. And how much your job, your occupation, the university major, the college that you are studying, helps you to promote yourself. You know, this is good. Okay, you might be an expert in a specific field of study, but when you cannot interact with the people outside, you use foul language, you cannot act in a proper way in a society, what type of knowledge or education it might be? I think the higher education is very much higher than the college and the university, but the college and university, if it is mingled with practice, I mean skill, on that time it would be great, but the mere degree, unfortunately, does not help anyone. And I think today's world is very much looking for the degrees.
Not necessarily.
No,
the people are looking for the skill. So I might have 5 degrees, but I don't know how to work,
okay.
how to solve a problem, how to run a business, how to manage a department.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a, I don't care even if you have 10 degrees or you're a
mm-hmm.
Nobel Prize winner, but if
yes.
you can't get the things done, we don't need you.
That's right. Okay. Thank you, Masha Qasem and Sheikh Ali Himani for your presence in the program. Viewpoints, it was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN/Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organization, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the U.S.-engineered regime change plot in Pakistan and how Prime Minister Imran Khan thwarted the hideous move. And we shall take a look at political tensions